The market doesn't joke around, so why would you? Get serious. Choose Tastytrade. Tastytrade gives you the tools you need to make smarter moves. Dig into data with advanced charting, track profit accurately with order chain trackers, see risk clearly with curve analysis, and trade with low-capped commissions, stocks, options, futures, and more. All on one platform. No wonder serious traders choose Tastytrade. Join the club, genius. Tasty Trading is a registered broker-dealer and member of FINRA and SIPC.
Bring in show music, please.
Hi, I'm CNBC producer Katie Kramer. Today on Squawk Pod. China's auto dominance. The world's second largest economy is driving new cars and new electric vehicles into markets all over the world, while the U.S. looks at restricting Chinese technology. Council on Foreign Relations head Michael Froman.
All right, there's a trade-off here. Do we want a U.S. EV industry? And what cost are we willing to pay for
that? We have one. It's called Tesla.
Anti-Semitism's rise in the wake of the Israel-Hamas war. The Anti-Defamation League's Jonathan Greenblatt on the scale of the problem.
The lack of leadership at these college campuses is a catastrophe.
Plus, once more narrowly averting a government shutdown. The latest reporting from Emily Wilkins in D.C.
Seems like the fourth time is maybe not quite yet the charm.
Oprah parting ways with Weight Watchers, the SEC looking into OpenAI's texts, and what we all got wrong about Wendy's dynamic pricing.
And you can get the burger, the chicken nuggets for 99 cents or something. You might actually say, okay, I'll go do that.
It's Thursday, February 29th. Happy Leap Day. Squawk Pod begins right now.
Stand Becky by in 3, 2, 1, cue please.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to Squawk Box right here on CNBC. We are live from the NASDAQ market site in Times Square. I'm Becky Quick, along with Joe Kernan and Andrew Ross Sorkin. And here we go. Let's take a look at the U.S. equity future.
We have been working in good faith around the clock every single day for months and weeks and over the last several days. We believe that we can get to agreement on these issues and prevent a government shutdown. And that's our first responsibility.
Do you have your mind on government?
Already working.
Meantime, congressional leaders have reached a partial budget deal to temporarily avert a government shutdown. We've been having these government shutdowns and temporary versions for quite some time now. Emily Wilkins in Washington, D.C. this morning joins us with the latest. Good morning.
Good morning, Andrew. Yeah, it seems like the fourth time is maybe not quite yet the charm. The House plans to vote today on a temporary funding measure that will likely prevent a government shutdown from happening at midnight on Saturday. The stopgap measure was agreed to by congressional leaders yesterday to buy them more time to negotiate a spending deal for the rest of the fiscal year, so toward the end of September. Now, both chambers are racing to pass the bill by the end of Friday night. Congress would have until March 8th to pass half of the bills needed to fully fund the government for the duration of the fiscal year under this new plan. And that would include the Departments of Energy, Commerce, Justice, and others. The rest of government funding, now that includes the Defense Department and financial regulators, would need to be completed by March 22nd. So those are your two new deadlines, March 8th, March 22nd. Lawmakers working to appropriate funding said they're confident that this first group of bills can be done in time for next week, but they acknowledge that it's the second group that's going to be more difficult to do. Republicans are continuing to push for at least some of their conservative priorities to be included in the bills, although it's not clear what, if any, can get the bipartisan support needed to pass. And of course, extending these funding deadlines, it does delay other key legislation that Congress is working on. This includes, of course, funding for Ukraine and Israel, as well as that tax package that would offer benefits to companies and parents that you saw the House pass several weeks ago. And you're still waiting for the Senate to see exactly what they do with it. Andrew?
Thank you for that. Meantime, we should tell you that Speaker Johnson now promising there wouldn't be another stopgap. So what kind of blowback is he facing from inside his own conference at this point in the ballgame?
Well, Andrew, members aren't exactly happy about this, especially those hardline conservatives that gave Kevin McCarthy so much trouble. At the same point, from just the members who I spoke with last night, talked with Bob Good, the head of the Freedom Caucus, and he said, look, you know, members aren't happy. We don't want to have another stopgap spending. There's some discussion about whether we're going to see more Republicans oppose this stopgap than the last stopgap. But at the same point, it doesn't seem like there's any appetite at this point to try and oust Speaker Johnson. I think there's kind of a sense that that's just not something Republicans want to do right now. They don't see it as being productive in an election year. And while they're not happy about the course that things are taking, the way that Johnson is going to be moving this bill through the House, there's really not much that these hardliners can do to block it.
Emily Wilkins, thank you for walking us through where things stand as we speak. I'm sure we'll be talking a lot more about this, perhaps again with you tomorrow morning. Thanks.
Shares of WW International, that's the company that was formerly known as Weight Watchers, they've been tumbling by 23% in extended trading. This came after Oprah Winfrey said late yesterday that she plans to leave the board and that she's donating her stake in the company to the National Museum of African American History and Culture. That company's been struggling to stay relevant in the Ozempic era. Winfrey recently disclosed that she was taking the popular weight loss drug as a maintenance tool. She's been amazing, kind of watching how she has kept this weight off. Last year, the company acquired telemedicine startup to help give members access to the weight loss drugs. For the fourth quarter, WW reported subscriber numbers at the light end of the guided range, and full-year revenue guidance also came in lower than expected. And we should note that the market cap has now fallen to $232 million. So it's not even a company that we would normally cover.
But when your board member and your effective spokesman, if you will, I don't know if you would say she was a spokesman, is now taking effectively
it just totally unbinds
the entire business.
It's totally irrelevant. And it was long before she left. It was totally. That's why it's at $2.
Well, it was right. It was a complicated. Right. I'm not saying that the business wasn't complicated beforehand, but now it is officially complicated.
It's over because of Ozempic.
Remember, people thought it was irrelevant, and then she joined it.
Right.
Right. But that was before. That was the world has changed.
And now talk about it every day.
Fully. And just like Salesforce down $5 is only 1%, this is 89 cents and it's 23%. So, that's been a long, sickening decline. But I'd still rather, what do? They sell some low calorie like food and stuff instead of sticking a needle in my stomach.
No, they're selling you on, one, two, three. You know, they have all these rules about
you don't have to stick needles in your stomach, do you?
No, it's a lot easier to follow.
Now that I think about it, I probably wouldn't even feel it. It's so fat.
Let's talk about some news overnight that's raising a lot of eyebrows.
What was that?
This morning on Wall Street, Joe.
I know your stomach is, but the SEC. Did I feel something?
The SEC looking into internal communications by OpenAI CEO Sam Altman. A lot of folks in the Valley looking at this and trying to question what's really happening here. Part of an investigation into whether the company's investors were misled. Sources telling the Wall Street Journal the probe was a predictable response after the company's board said in November that Altman hadn't been consistently candid in his communications. That board used that as part of the rationale, if you remember, for firing Altman, who then returned less than 2 weeks later under an overhaul board. The report notes that the SEC often closes investigations without making formal accusations of wrongdoing. So unclear where this is all going to go. Maybe this is all perfunctory, but we will we may learn more. There's also an internal investigation, which OpenAI's law firm is doing. I don't know what we're going to learn from that.
My guess is this is the first of several Washington entreaties into it, because we've heard Ro Khanna and others say that they would like to see more and hear more about what happened.
What
actually happened.
So you're back.
I am.
Good to have you. So I can ask you this. So needles, would you prefer forehead, lips, or stomach? I could never be a drug addict. I could never be a really good drug addict unless it was.
I've given myself shots in the stomach.
Before. You have.
I have.
That's not that bad.
No.
Really?
But I mean, my face. I don't think I could.
People get them in the forehead all the time, and lips. I'm just wondering what if you had to choose. So you would choose stomach.
Yeah.
So Ozempic's not. I can't believe you give it to yourself. It just comes pre-ready to go, and you just. Mm. Like Pulp Fiction, it's got a.
Well, I haven't done Ozempic or anything, but I don't know how long those.
We're not
are.
Saying you did. You naturally look like this. You don't need.
No, this is the result of not eating for 3 days.
You weren't eating for 3 days.
No.
Did you tell Andrew. She hasn't been eating for 3 days. Now a follow-up to a story we told you about earlier this week. Wendy's is clarifying plans for dynamic, so-called dynamic pricing after facing backlash online. and accusations of price gouging from politicians. Wendy's posted a statement on its website saying that its dynamic pricing plan has been misconstrued. It says it doesn't plan to raise prices at the busiest times and instead would use its new digital menu boards to change menu offerings during the day and offer discounts.
Well, no, so I said
it's
this.
A carrot, not
particularly
a
at slower times.
I said this
that's
the other day
that's
on,
not so bad.
On I think Morning Joe on another network that the only that if at a busy time it doesn't work, but actually at a slow time it could work. So if you were driving past a Wendy's and there's a digital board up, and it's I don't know
sale.
10:30, 11 in the morning is a slow time, and or
sale,
three
yeah.
in the afternoon or something, and somehow there's a sale on, and you can get I don't know the burger, the chicken nuggets for 99 cents or something, you might actually say,
yes.
okay, I'll go do that.
That's totally different. And that
that's
is a good
totally
idea.
Different.
Yeah, it's a good
but
idea.
If it's at lunchtime or at dinner
yeah,
time,
and they're raising prices.
And they're raising prices, and then you see that McDonald's is across the street because most
well,
of these places have
who's
five of these
for,
things lined up next to each other, you're going to go to the other
then
one.
We got it wrong. We got the story wrong by saying they were going to do it at busy times and raise prices. If the prices are staying where they are or lower, that's totally different than where they are or
I
higher.
I disagree.
But over time.
They didn't explain that,
you
though.
Have to, yeah,
yes.
But over time, the question becomes.
Do you raise it up and then
raise
go down?
It and to, like, do your base level prices go up so that you can then offer the discount yeah. at other times?
Do you eat at Wendy's?
Over time.
Sometimes.
The one thing I will say is it's a competitive industry. It's a competitive yeah. industry.
Super so. Competitive because they're all next yeah. to each other.
Right.
Like
yeah.
every
and
street has.
Anybody who doesn't
if there's
have
a Wendy's,
deals,
there's a KFC yeah. and a McDonald's
and
within
a Taco Bell. If it's a decent
spitting distance.
It's a decent street. It does.
Cheese will be next.
Coming up on Squawk Pod, Chinese cars, connected cars, and the possibility your data could be compromised when you drive around what's basically a smartphone on wheels. Our automotive correspondent Phil Lebeau is in Santiago, Chile, for a look at a country that has embraced the rise of China's car manufacturing. And Michael Froman, president of the Council on Foreign Relations, on the risks Americans still see from China's car market.
They're trying to get ahead of it this time and say, this is a key sector for our economy. We don't want to find ourselves in the same situation we were in other sectors where we saw the overcapacity being built.
Swing into Seaside Golf in Ocean City, Maryland. Play like a pro at 17 championship courses designed by golf legends like Jack Nicklaus and Arthur Hills. Tee off on sweeping vistas at Eagle's Landing. Savor the coastal views of Lighthouse Sound. Or see why Ocean City Golf Club is considered one of the Mid-Atlantic's finest fairways. Whether you're sneaking in a quick round on a family vacation or going all in on a golf getaway, fun is always in play at Ocean City, Maryland. Plan your trip at OCOcean.com.
What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
You're listening to Squawk Pod.
Stand by, Joe. His mic, cue.
Good morning and welcome back to Squawk Box here on CNBC, live from the NASDAQ market site in Times Square. I'm Joe Kernan, along with Becky Quick and Andrew Ross Sorkin. And not a pretty picture. Now that is. That's a beautiful picture.
Now you just sound like you are spoiled. You know,
I want it to go up every damn day. Every day. I want it up. I like let the good times roll.
Chinese brand vehicles are seeing stronger demand around the world. Our Phil Lebeau has more on China's auto revolution from one country buying in, Chile.
Buenos dias, Becky, here in Santiago, Chile, where Chinese autos are not hard to find. In fact, this is one of the primary markets separate from the major markets where you have seen a boom in the sales of Chinese-built vehicles that have been exported and sold in this country. How many vehicles are exported from China? They are now number one in the world. A 62% increase in auto exports last year. And let's be clear here. The vast majority of the vehicles being exported are gasoline-powered internal combustion engine vehicles. Just 29% are electric vehicles. So we wanted to find out, what's the appeal? Are people embracing Chinese vehicles? Clearly they are, because sales are going so strong. We went to an auto mall, literally a mall that has all of the major automakers, including automakers from the United States, like Ford, like General Motors. And we asked people, look, what's making this so attractive to you that you want to buy an auto here in Chile that was built in China? And one of the dealers told us something very interesting. He said, there is an ability for the people here to get past the idea of a car being built in China. That hesitancy has faded away. So what are the primary markets where the Chinese are exporting their vehicles? First is Russia. Once the Europeans pulled out following the war in Ukraine, then China stepped in, supplying the vast majority of the new vehicles that are sold in Russia. But Mexico is a close number two. In fact, in Mexico, Chinese-built vehicles are now 10% of the market. And when you talk with the experts, they all say the same thing. It's only a matter of time until they actually build in Mexico and start exporting to the United States. Guys, the bottom line is this. What we're seeing here in Chile, we're seeing in other countries, in Australia, in Israel. You go around the world, if there is not a manufacturer in that country, and even if there is a manufacturer in that country, the wave of exported vehicles from China quickly resonates with buyers, in part because of the cost, and they're better made now. They're more reliable than they used to be, and that's the reason why they are so successful in countries like Chile.
So for the U.S. automakers, can they compete, or will they look to Washington for higher tariffs and try to make sure?
They're going to look to Washington. There's already a 25% tariff for anything that is built in China, a vehicle, and then exported to the United States, regardless of who it is, whether it's a Chinese automaker or General Motors or Tesla. That's why Tesla builds in China but exports to other markets. They don't export from China into the United States anymore. They did initially, but not they don't do that right now. And so what you're seeing, Becky, is that for the U.S. automakers, they will increasingly turn to Washington and say, look, if you don't do something in terms of trade policy, when the Chinese automakers are building in Mexico, which is the plan within the next 5, 6, 7 years, then something is going to happen to the U.S. market where the Chinese come in, they will undercut on price, and they will start gaining market share. That's the concern for U.S. automakers.
Phil, thank you.
And new this morning, the Commerce Department will be investigating national security risks from connected autos that have parts from China and other countries of concern. The department now worried about the personal data risk if your phone connects to your car, as well as the risk that the vehicle could be remotely disabled by bad actors. The department wants to take the action now before Chinese manufactured vehicles become widespread in the U.S. Joining us right now to talk about this and so much more, former U.S. Trade Representative Michael Froman. He's now Counsel on Foreign Relations President. It's great to have him at the table.
Great to be here.
You know, I take my phone and I plug it into the car. And now, by the way, you don't even need to plug it into the car half the time. But if you want the power, which my battery's always low, I need to. By the way, you do this all the time in so many places. How worried are, do you, by the way, that's actually maybe the better way to start. Do you plug in your phone?
I do the same.
I
do the same.
Okay.
Look, I think what it underscores is just how one connected we are and how vulnerable we are to potential cyber attacks from China or from elsewhere, from just bad actors anywhere in our daily life.
But do you think we're particularly vulnerable to China? I mean, I think that actually is the fundamental question with all, you know, every day we have a different headline about China security risk, you know, or it's TikTok or it's this or it's that. Are the risks coming from China severely more dangerous than anywhere else?
You know, I think this week we've seen a couple things. One is a new executive order sort of regulating the sale of data by data brokers, including to China and five other countries. And then we've seen movement on the Hill with a bill to put 100% tariffs on imports of cars from China. So I think there's a particular focus on China. I'm not sure the cyber security risk is specifically focused on China or should be specifically focused on China. There are plenty of bad actors out there engaging in cyber security intrusions. But there is concern that China is building up significant overcapacity in the auto sector, particularly the electric vehicle sector. And unlike steel and aluminum and solar panels, there's an effort to get ahead of it this time and try and figure out what do we do to make sure they're not dumping those cars on our markets and undermining
our industry. How much of this is a security concern and how much of this is an economic concern?
Well, right now we have very little imports from China of autos, about $2 billion a year, and mostly, by the way, from GM and Ford, from U.S. automakers who produce in China. It's not the big Chinese
EV companies.
But we
just heard from Phil, our last report was about how they are building, they're going to be building in Mexico. If you've got NAFTA and stuff comes across the border.
Huge capacity. And I think that's what people are focused on. They're, again, trying to get ahead of it this time and say, this is a key sector for our economy. We don't want to find ourselves in the same situation we were in other sectors where we saw the overcapacity being built. The Chinese have to do something with all that overcapacity.
But here's the other conundrum. I don't know if you've seen some of the comments that Elon Musk has made over the past couple of weeks. He would tell you that the BYD vehicles are better than the vehicles that are being manufactured by just about every U.S. manufacturer except, in his mind, Tesla. Now, you could say that that is a, you may think he has motivations to say that for different reasons, but for what I don't disbelieve him, and there are a lot of people who've driven in the latest BYD vehicles who say, this is pretty amazing.
There are several Chinese EV companies producing several kinds of electric vehicles that are very good. And so I think it's putting a challenge on our industry to continue to innovate and continue to try and come up with new models that people want. And these sorts of actions are about giving them the space to do that. Now, we could say, is that the best thing for consumers? But here, again, I think the paradigm has shifted where it's not all about consumers anymore. It's not all about efficiency, getting the cheapest product to consumers or the cheapest, best product into the hands of consumers. There's an effort to say, well, we want redundancy, we want resilience, we want security, we want to have our own industry in key sectors, even if it means imposing a cost on consumers.
You're describing a really bad scenario for me. Not only do the big three got to compete against Tesla's EVs, now even China has great EVs.
Yep.
We just signed these labor agreements that make it very difficult to foresee how the big three can be competitive already with Tesla, non-union. Looks to me like the only way it's going to happen is the government's going to have to support the big three somehow, again.
Look, I would underestimate the capacity of the big three to continue to innovate. I think GM and others have been trying to innovate.
What evidence? Where have we seen them innovate in the last 10 years?
I think a number of them have been
trying
to move
forward. Can't park near the front of your, was it the Volt or the Bolt that you can't park near your house? If you have a wooden house, you can't park it near there because your house is going to go up.
Yeah. Like, this is a new sector. There's going to be a lot of change, a lot of new infrastructure being built. And I think the big three are trying very hard to play a significant role.
Who wants a big three EV? No, they haven't found a person yet.
Well, I don't think that's true, Joe. But I think what they're trying to do is create the space for it. Now, I think it comes at a cost. And I think politicians need to say, all right, there's a trade-off here. Do we want a U.S. EV industry? And what cost are we willing to pay for
that? We have one. It's called Tesla.
That's what, do we want more than that? And do we want a competitive industry?
If you build it, they will come. That they haven't built it yet.
Yeah. Well, but the question is, if we let these cars in, maybe they would. And that's the flip side.
You think the competition would make them better, you mean?
I could argue to you that
Why
one of the reasons
Tesla
that
enough?
EV take-up has not been as high is because the actual cars themselves are not good enough.
All right,
it's
I
the
agree.
Product's problem.
But you've already got Tesla as a model of what you'd like to be, and they're nowhere near that. And
so you're happy to have a monopoly.
Huh?
You're happy to have a monopoly.
I'm not saying I'm happy, but if it's a monopoly based on how good your product is, I mean, we've seen that in big tech, too. Do you close down a big tech company just because they're so good at what they do?
Yeah.
That's Peter Thiel's got a book out called that.
Winner takes all.
No, I forget what it's called.
But that's the theory.
But it's about.
That is the theory.
If you're really that good, you have a natural monopoly, but it's not illegal.
Yeah,
but it also.
Except Lena Khan would call it
you
illegal.
You also forget the fact that all of these things, all of this industry is put together by the U.S. government.
Yeah, but at least people come out to my neighborhood. Every car is a Tesla. Everyone.
Michael Froman, thank you. By the way, the Peter Thiel book, 0 to 1.
0 to 1.
That's the name of the book.
Next on Squawk Pod, the shocking rise in anti-Semitism. Jonathan Greenblatt, Anti-Defamation League CEO, is looking at college campuses and what academic leaders should do.
If you have a DEI program that doesn't include Jews, the most targeted religious minority, you're doing it wrong. That's the opposite of diversity.
Swing into Seaside Golf in Ocean City, Maryland. Play like a pro at 17 championship courses designed by golf legends like Jack Nicklaus and Arthur Hills. Tee off on sweeping vistas at Eagle's Landing. Savor the coastal views of Lighthouse Sound. Or see why Ocean City Golf Club is considered one of the Mid-Atlantic's finest fairways. Whether you're sneaking in a quick round on a family vacation or going all in on a golf getaway, fun is always in play at Ocean City, Maryland. Plan your trip at OCOcean.com.
This is Squawk Pod from CNBC. Here's Andrew Ross Sorkin.
A new survey by the Anti-Defamation League finding that anti-Semitism is still on the rise in America. Results show that nearly one in four Americans are prone to believe in anti-Jewish conspiracy theories. It's the highest level in more than three decades and up from 20% 2 years ago. The survey also showed that more than 42% of Americans either have friends or family who dislike Jews or find it socially unacceptable for a close family member to support Hamas. For more on the findings, I want to bring in Jonathan Greenblatt, CEO, National Director of the Anti-Defamation League. Surprised by these results?
Unfortunately, I'm not. I mean, we have watched at ADL this trend line move in the wrong direction for the last five plus years. And to think in 2019, it was just 11% of Americans who had extensive, you know, intense anti-Semitic attitudes. So to see that more than double in just 5 years is shocking. But look, this is playing out on our college campuses. This is playing out in public spaces. So it's not entirely a surprise.
These polls were taken when?
In the first half of January. Okay. So this is, you know, ADL's been studying anti-Semitic attitudes since the 1960s. And we run these sort of like sentiment analyses every 2 to 3 years to gauge in baseline where public attitudes are.
How connected do you believe that these results are to what's happened in Israel and to the response that Israel has had to the attacks?
Well, look, it's a good question. I think in 2016, things started to change when extremists started to feel like they had permission to express anti-Semitic attitudes. And then since the October 7th massacre, like the sewers, the lids have been blown off the sewers by the anti-Zionists. So keep
in mind. I don't want to conflate anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism, but
they're two hues of the same color.
Okay.
But here's what
continue on.
I mean, here's what I would tell you. In 2022, right, when Israel had a coalition government with Arabs and Jews in the government, Muslims and Jews working together, we had the most number of anti-Semitic incidents we ever tracked in America. So this idea that Israel causes anti-Semitism is wrong.
Andrew, I mentioned the piece in the journal today. Interesting. Last two sentences. Progressives claim that being anti-Israel or anti-Zionist isn't the same thing as being anti-Semitic. Tuesdays at Berkeley shows how dishonest that claim is. And if you don't know what happened in Berkeley, and my point is, okay, we learned nothing from Harvard. We learned nothing from what we've seen at all these Ivy League campuses. Berkeley, what is Berkeley known for? The most progressive campus in the country. Nothing is worse. They don't suspend these students that show up and spit on these kids and make these kids think that they may not walk out of there alive. They don't even suspend them. Nothing has changed, Jonathan.
The lack of leadership at these college campuses is a catastrophe.
And nothing's changed. You've made no progress, have you?
Well, we are pressing Title VI cases against many of these institutions, right? We're going to hold them accountable. We've been working with the Education Committee in the House to put them in front, and we saw what happened at Harvard and at Penn. So they're being held accountable, and I'm told that applications are dramatically down at Harvard. And you saw the Jeff Sonnenfeld story in the Journal last week.
This was this week.
I know. I mean, this was Sunday night. And so for the viewers who don't know, two Jewish women were assaulted by a throng of pro-Hamas protesters. Right. And look, something is profoundly wrong when the university thinks it's normal for people to converge on the campus with their faces totally covered by scarves.
They said they're helpless. Screaming, the administrators say they're helpless. Nothing they can do about it.
Well, here's what you can do. Number one, enforce the law. You break windows, you assault people, you should be arrested. Number two, ban masks on college campuses. I'm not talking about a COVID protection. I'm talking about someone who's there and screaming about the Intifada, then assaulting people. How does anyone think that's normal? And then number three, I think the thing we also need to talk about is we need to overhaul, and I've talked about it in the show before, we need to overhaul DEI. Because the idea of diversity, equity, and inclusion that perpetuates the exclusion of Jews is just wrong. And I believe in diversity education. I think it is important, but it's got to be done differently.
Okay, so how would you do it?
Better. How do we do diversity education differently? I think, you know, most of these programs, we've studied them.
And are you talking about DEI programs inside universities? You're talking about DEI programs inside
corporations,
businesses?
Okay. Et cetera.
Okay,
like, so this is why we launched our workforce pledge at ADL. 250 plus companies have joined. If you have a DEI program that doesn't include Jews, the most targeted religious minority, you're doing it wrong. That's the opposite of diversity. So that's got to change. So we think that companies need to either adapt and rethink the way they're doing this all together. That's overdue to happen in all these places.
What should Netanyahu do at this point?
What should Bibi do?
Yeah, and what should Biden be doing? He's already under some pressure, Hamas is not, it's nowhere close to taken care of at this point.
Look, number one, the hostages need to come home yesterday. Right? That's the thing that I know I'm focused on. It's why I wear the ribbon. It's why I wear my dog tag. They've got to come home. Beyond that, like, I'm not a military strategist. I'm focused on fighting hate here in America.
But I don't think that the political will is going to be there for them to do what they need to do because of exactly what you're talking about.
It is alarming to see how the sand seems to be shifting. And
you predicted it. You said that there's no way public opinion is going to hold up to do what is not to eradicate Hamas.
Is a genocidal organization that prioritizes killing Jews. It should be unacceptable yesterday, today, and tomorrow. So whatever the future government in Gaza might be, it can't.
Okay, but so what did you think about
Hamas.
What happened in Michigan?
Meaning the people voting on committee. I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm old enough to remember when you were upset about policies that a government was doing or that your political party was doing, you actually got involved. You didn't pull back. You said, I want a seat at the table and I'm going to earn it and then demand. I think what's happened
you don't
is
think
ridiculous.
That would, so you don't
and
think
how's that going to help like economic opportunity for the people of Michigan? How's that going to help make that state better? How's that going to help
you
the Democratic
the
Party
vote,
win?
The people who just voted.
These people voting uncommitted, I think it's pathetic. And if they really want to make a difference, they should roll up their sleeves and get involved. But you know what, Andrew? I hope they like what the other guy will do. I'm sure he'll listen to them, you know? I mean, it's absurd.
The institutional, you said it's taken years for this to happen. The academic makeup of these colleges hasn't changed one iota.
What do you mean the academic makeup?
The people that have been hired and have tenure that are where a lot of these ideas are being sown and put. I don't think these students, are they coming up with all this on their own? This is not being taught? And how do you slowly how do you weed out what we're seeing on all of our best
not just being taught on college campuses. You look at TikTok, you look at any of these.
Yeah, I mean, social media is, we've talked about, it's a super spreader of hate. Mm-hmm. But the cultural rot at these institutions, you know, you need to go in there and remediate it one by one.
It's not going to happen. How are you going to do that?
Yeah, let me ask you a different question. You just said, what's the other guy going to do?
Yeah.
There is a view the other guy, who's former President Trump, is more, look, some people say he's more pro-Israel. And then there's other people who would say that he has said things that are anti-Semitic himself. What do you think?
Well, look, President Trump has a closer relationship to the Jewish people than any president in history because he has Jewish grandchildren in the West Wing. And he clearly has a set of views. I don't agree with everything that he's done or did. But look at the Abraham Accords. That was unquestionably
good. Right, so for your purposes, when you said, well, what's the other guy going to do?
Well, I think
for your purposes, where do you land on that? That's a very interesting question.
We're a tax-exempt apolitical organization, but we're doing our big conference next week, and we're hosting Jared Kushner at the ADL's Never Is Now conference, along with Albert Bourla and Julie Sweet and Mark Rowan. And why are we hosting him? Because the Abraham Accords, whether or not you like what the Trump administration did, were unquestionably good. And we need to be bipartisan. Here's what I would say, Andrew. More than ever, our Jewish community and really the country needs to find ways to come together. If you only see the world tinged through your lens of red or blue, you're seeing things wrong. And like, Joe, I mean, I got to tell you, I know you have a lot of strong feelings about this, but if this country doesn't come together, you know, divided we fall. I mean, I don't understand why this is so hard.
The side I'm representing isn't responsible for the division. And to hear Hunter trashing Jared, did you hear that yesterday? I said, well, what about that? That was his defense for his escapades.
Look, I can't speak. I don't want to talk about Hunter Biden, but what I will tell you is this. there is good and bad on both sides, and you got to listen to people.
Well, I'm glad you said that. At least he's got grandchildren and living in the White House, so you know you've said it a bunch of times, Charlottesville or whatever. I mean, let's be live in the real world, shall we? His daughter, I mean, it's Jewish kids, Jewish grandkids.
Jonathan Greenblatt, thank you very, very much.
Thank you, guys.
That's Squawk Pod for today. I'm Katie Kramer, and I'm so grateful to you for being here. I'd also be grateful if you'd be so kind to rate or review this podcast. More ratings, more feedback, especially on Apple Podcasts, really helps other listeners find us. Squawk Box is hosted by Joe Kernan, Becky Quick, and Andrew Ross Sorkin. Tune in weekday mornings on CNBC at 6 Eastern, and podcast listeners, we'll meet you right back here tomorrow.
We are clear. Thanks, guys.
Swing into Seaside Golf in Ocean City, Maryland. Play like a pro at 17 championship courses designed by golf legends like Jack Nicklaus and Arthur Hills. Tee off on sweeping vistas at Eagle's Landing. Savor the coastal views of Lighthouse Sound. Or see why Ocean City Golf Club is considered one of the Mid-Atlantic's finest fairways. Whether you're sneaking in a quick round on a family vacation or going all in on a golf getaway, fun is always in play at Ocean City, Maryland. Plan your trip at OCOcean.com.